First, a look at the global economy and its intersection with politics. We often look at China, as you know, here on Saturday Extra, and how its economy is changing the world. I think it's arguable to say that the biggest variable, though, in the global economy at the moment is the United States. Why so? Well, having recovered slowly from the crash, the US economy is expected now to grow by more than 2% this year. In response, the Federal Reserve has started to increase interest rates to keep a lid on inflation. How the bank's decisions play against President Trump's target of a whopping 4% growth is being watched closely by Sebastian Mallaby, because he detects some big political stoushes ahead in this arena. Their full impact not well grasped, he believes, because people are preoccupied with day-to-day beltway dramas. Mr. Mallaby is the Paul Volcker Senior Fellow in International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also in Sydney for the Sydney Writers' Festival. His most recent book is the award-winning biography of former Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. Hello, Sebastian.
Nice to be with you.
Welcome to Australia, as they say.
Thank you.
In the midst of such turmoil within US politics, how well do you judge the US economy to be?
Well, the funny saying that central bankers always have is the economy is doing well, much too well. Because when they see it doing too well, of course, they worry that it'll overheat, there'll be inflation and so on. And I think that's where we are now. You know, the economy, as you said, is forecast to grow to more than 2%. The median estimate amongst the policymakers at the Federal Reserve is that 1.8% is the sustainable rate of growth. You've got a labor market which is pretty tight, so unemployment is right now at 4.4%. That's extremely low.
That's across America, is it?
Across America, yeah. I mean, basically, the labor market is tight. There are not that many people out of work. And when that happens, normally, you start to see some price pressure.
So when you say not sustainable, you are talking about inflation, that basically there will be scarcities evolve in this, and then that will ultimately push prices up and wages will go up. Is that what you mean?
Well, and also I think that the Fed will feel that to prevent the prices from going up too much, it will have to continue to tighten interest rates gradually but slowly.
And therefore possibly snuffing out new businesses.
Perhaps, yes, and also making the dollar stronger. When you raise interest rates, typically your currency goes up, and of course that's not always politically popular.
That 4%, which is a low figure, that would not be uniform, of course, across the whole of the US. Like, say, some of even those Rust Belt states which elected Donald Trump, which have just seen the demise of manufacturing, are they also getting the yield of this?
Well, of course, it's uneven. In any continental size economy, you're not going to have lockstep progress all across. But even in Appalachia, in the depressed parts of the, you know, deindustrializing Midwest, you've got a relatively strong economy. You've got pockets, I think, which are kind of culturally challenged. You know, the sort of addiction to prescription painkillers, the rate of family breakdown and so forth, that make it very hard to see people getting back into the labor force and staying there. But that's kind of a cultural challenge more than a macroeconomic one.
Economists don't normally say that back to me like that. Have you changed your mind on this yourself in terms of looking at the limits of what a state can do or economic levers can do?
I think the state could do more than it's doing in a couple of ways. One is actually that one of the features of the American economy right now is that concentration has gone up. Competition has been reduced. More of the key industries, take airlines, take other things, there are fewer big companies dominating the market. And that means that they have pricing power both over consumers, but also over their employees. So the competition for hiring workers is a bit diminished if there's only two or three big elephants in the room doing the hiring. And I think some of the problem with stagnant middle-class wages can be ascribed to that lack of competition in the US economy. And I think a sort of return to trust busting, to a tougher line on...
Which is what Theodore Roosevelt did, of course, at the turn of into the 20th century.
Exactly.
Took on all those yes. big gilded magnates.
So I think government could be more proactive on that. And government could also be more proactive on helping with the retraining and with those cultural challenges I was talking about. That, you know, if you think about the way that when the agricultural sector began its big secular decline because the mechanization of agriculture meant that you needed fewer workers, the enormous amounts of subsidies that were pushed towards farmers to keep them afloat was just an order of magnitude bigger than anything we've ever done for the manufacturing sector, which is now facing its own decline. And I think that to get a sense of the scale of the assistance that might be needed to cushion the political shock of competition with China and so forth, and with the mechanization because of robots, maybe we need to think bigger about how much retraining the government should be sponsoring, and active labor market policies that don't just say, you're unemployed, now go get on your bike and find a job. It says, you're unemployed, now we're going to help you with retraining.
This is not normally the script for American capitalism.
Well, American capitalism has been tough, but, you know, there's a question of what a modern democracy will tolerate. We're not going to go back to, you know, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath with kind of Dust Bowl families trekking hungrily, across the West in search of labor. I mean, we don't want that, and nor would the political system tolerate it. I mean, the political system's already risen up in revolt to some extent by electing Donald Trump, and that's enough radicalism for most people. So I think we don't want more of that, but what we do want is intelligent management of the transitional challenges of an economy which is being robotized at a high rate.
So let's talk about what does worry you then. You were writing recently in The Atlantic that a normal political climate would throw up some difficulties, but this is not normal at all. Are there other things that keep you awake at night?
I think the big question about the President Trump administration is whether it's just a sort of temporary nightmare or whether it's a lasting problem. And the lasting problems come where there are essentially attacks on the institutions of American life, which leave a residue after Trump is gone. And one such might be the independence of the central bank. I mean, for 25 years now, it's been taken as normal that the Fed should be left to do its business and move interest rates as it technocratically chooses. But I think if Donald Trump were to attack the Fed, that could change the game.
Well, you have actually written that it is possible to imagine a concerted attack upon the Fed. What gives you evidence of that? Could it be rebutted? Is Janet Yellen the type to rebut it?
Well, the evidence for it being a plausible outcome is that Donald Trump in the campaign already broke with precedent by calling Janet Yellen out, the Fed chair, by name on primetime television in one of the debates with Hillary Clinton, and saying that she was essentially in the pocket of the Democrats and was running interest rates low in order to ensure a Democratic re-election. So he's been willing to attack the Fed already. Now, I think he might be further willing because he has this aspiration on his website still of 4% growth, even when his Treasury Secretary is being a bit sensible and dials that number back. They're dialing it back to 3% growth, which is still way above what any sensible economist believes is doable. So because of this excessively ambitious target for growth, the Trump administration is going to be impatient with the Fed if it raises interest rates to keep growth within the range that the Fed sees as plausible, which is more like 1.8 or 2%. And so I think you can see the logic, both that Trump has the appetite for attacking the Fed, he's done it before, and that he will have cause to do so when, as he sees it, his growth ambitions are being choked back by the central bank.
Mm. Just tell us a little, if you could. Sebastian Mallaby's my guest, by the way. He's here for the Sydney Writers Festival, and he's the Paul Volcker Senior Fellow in International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also written about Alan Greenspan. So tell us about Janet Yellen. You know, you've watched her as a senior bureaucrat. We watch her as well, but I feel she's I think she feels like quite an enigma from here in Australia.
Well, one difference between Janet Yellen and the man whose biography I wrote, Alan Greenspan, is that Alan Greenspan was political to his fingertips. I mean, he was a master Machiavellian operator. So when he was attacked in the early 90s by President George H.W. Bush, he knew how to fight back. And when they punched him on the nose, he punched them back twice. Janet Yellen, on the other hand, is more of a technocrat's technocrat, more of a pure economist. And if she has a political side, it is a heavily democratic network that she has. I don't think she's got friends in the Republican Party, either in the administration or indeed in Congress. And that limits her ability to fight back in a Washington that is currently dominated by the Republican Party. So whereas Greenspan was successful in resisting presidential pressure, I'm not sure that Janet Yellen has quite the same network that enables her to do the same thing.
Before I let you go, the stock market in the US has soared after Trump's election. Does that concern you at all? I mean,
it does concern me. I mean, it is an enigma, right? Because the stock market took off after the November election on the theory that, you know, hey, Donald Trump is in power and he's going to do stuff that's good for business. He's going to deregulate, he's going to cut the corporate tax and so forth. Now, as it turns out, Trump looks like he's having difficulty getting anything much through Congress. He's still tied up with healthcare. He's talking about a tax cut, but, you know, some Republicans in Congress have said that his budget proposal is dead on arrival. So since he doesn't seem to be likely to deliver the policies that were the premise for the big stock market appreciation, it seems to me the stock market should now correct and go down again. But it hasn't. So I think it's a bit like one of those cartoon figures that's run over the cliff, is still having its legs, you know, pumping away and hasn't kind of descended yet.
What's the price to earnings ratio basically now?
It's at a historic high. I mean, I forget, you can calculate this different ways, but however you calculate the chart, it's kind of at the historic extreme of where it's been in the past. So I think it's richly valued. The policy environment, you've got a high volatility president, and yet a low volatility stock market. And I think that strange gap has to close somehow.
Sebastian Mallaby, thank you very much for joining us. It's been lovely to have you with us.
Great to be with you too.
Sebastian is the Paul Volcker Senior Fellow in International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has written the biography of the man many believe was one of the main architects of the financial crash, Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chief, obviously a very political man, as you just heard. It's called The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan.